Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Book 11, Chapter 6. Helena, having returned with the court from Vilna to Petersburg, found herself in a difficult position. In Petersburg, she had enjoyed the special protection of a grandee who occupied one of the highest posts in the empire. In Vilna, she had formed an intimacy with a young foreign prince. When she returned to Petersburg, both the magnate and the prince were there, and both claimed their rights. Helena was faced by a new problem: how to preserve her intimacy with both without offending either. What would have seemed difficult or even impossible to another woman did not cause the least embarrassment to Countess Bezukhova, who evidently deserved her reputation of being a very clever woman. Had she attempted concealment or tried to extricate herself from her awkward position by cunning, she would have spoiled her case by acknowledging herself guilty. But Helena, like a really great man who can do whatever he pleases, at once assumed her own position to be correct, as she sincerely believed it to be, and that everyone else was to blame. The first time the young foreigner allowed himself to reproach her, she lifted her beautiful head and, half turning to him, said firmly, "That's just like a man, selfish and cruel. I expected nothing else. A woman sacrifices herself for you, she suffers, and this is her reward. What right have you, Monseigneur, to demand an account of my attachments and friendships? He is a man who has been more than a father to me." The prince was about to say something, but Helena interrupted him. "Well, yes," she said, "it may be that he has other sentiments for me than those of a father, but that is not a reason for me to shut my door on him. I am not a man that I should repay kindness with ingratitude. Now, Monseigneur, that is all that relates to my intimate feelings. I render account only to God and to my conscience," she concluded, laying her hand on her beautiful, fully expanded bosom and looking up to heaven. "But for heaven's sake, listen to me. Marry me and I shall be your slave. But that's impossible." "You won't deign to demean yourself by marrying me, you," said Helena, beginning to cry. The prince tried to comfort her, but Helena, as if quite distraught, said through her tears that there was nothing to prevent her marrying, that there were precedents. There were, up to that time, very few, but she mentioned Napoleon and some other exalted personages. That she had never been her husband's wife, and that she had been sacrificed. "But the law, religion," said the prince, already yielding. "The law, religion. What have they been invented for if they can't arrange that?" said Helena. The prince was surprised that so simple an idea had not occurred to him, and he applied for advice to the Holy Brethren of the Society of Jesus, with whom he was on intimate terms. A few days later, at one of those enchanting fetes which Helena gave at her country house on the Stone Island, the charming Monsieur de Jaubert, a man no longer young, with snow-white hair and brilliant black eyes, a Jesu, a robe courtier, was presented to her. That translates to in walking dress. And in the garden, by the light of the illuminations and to the sound of music, talked to her for a long time of the love of God, of Christ, of the Sacred Heart, and of the consolations the one true Catholic religion affords in this world and the next. Helena was touched, and more than once tears rose to her eyes, and those of Monsieur de Jaubert and their voices trembled. A dance, for which her partner came to seek her, put an end to her discourse with her future directeur de conscience. But the next evening Monsieur de Jaubert came to see Helena when she was alone, and after that often came again. One day he took the countess to a Roman Catholic church, where she knelt down before the altar to which she was led. The enchanting middle-aged Frenchwoman laid his hands on her head, and As she herself afterwards described it, she felt something like a fresh breeze wafted into her soul. It was explaining to her that this was La Grace. After that, a long-frocked Abe was brought to her. She confessed to him, and he absolved her of her sins. Next day she received a box containing the sacred host, which she left at her house for her to partake of. A few days later, Helena learnt with pleasure that she had now been admitted to the true Catholic Church, and that in a few days the Pope himself would hear of her, and would send a certain document. All that was done around her and to her at this time, all the attention devoted to her by so many clever men and expressed in such pleasant, refined ways, and the state of dove-like purity she was now in, she wore only white dresses and white ribbons all the time, gave her pleasure. But her pleasure did not cause her for a moment to forget her aim. And as it always happens in contests of cunning, that a stupid person gets the better of cleverness, Helena, having realized that the main object of all these words and all this trouble was after converting her to Catholicism to obtain money from her for Jesuit institutions, as to which she received indications, before parting with her money, insisted that the various operations necessary to free her from her husband should be performed. In her view, the aim of every religion was merely to preserve certain proprieties while affording satisfaction to human desires, and with this aim, in one of her talks with her father confessor, she insisted on an answer to the question in how far was she bound by her marriage. They were sitting in the twilight by a window in the drawing room. The scent of flowers came in at the window. Helena was wearing a white dress transparent over her shoulders and bosom. The Abe, a well-fed man with a plump, clean-shaven chin, a pleasant firm mouth and white hands meekly folded on his knees, sat close to Helena, and with a subtle smile on his lips and a peaceful look of delight at her beauty, occasionally glanced at her face as he explained his opinion on the subject. Helena, with an uneasy smile, looked at his curly hair and his plump, clean-shaven, blackish cheeks, and every moment expected the conversation to take a fresh turn. But the Abe, though he evidently enjoyed the beauty of his companion, was absorbed in his mastery of the matter. The course of the father confessor's argument ran as follows. Ignorant of the import of what you were undertaking, you made a vow of conjugal fidelity to a man who, on his part, by entering the married state without faith in the religious significance of marriage, committed an act of sacrilege. That marriage lacked the dual significance it should have had, yet, in spite of this, your vow was binding. You swerved from it. What did you commit by so acting? A venial or a mortal sin? A venial sin, for you acted without evil intention. If now you married again with the object of bearing children, your sin might be forgiven. But the question is again a twofold one. Firstly, but suddenly Helena, who was getting bored, said with one of her bewitching smiles, but I think that having espoused the true religion, I cannot be bound by what a false religion laid upon me. The director of her conscience was astounded at having the case presented to him, thus with the simplicity of Columbus's egg. He was delighted at the unexpected rapidity of the pupil's progress, but could not abandon the edifice of argument he had laboriously constructed. "Let us understand one another, Countess," said he with a smile, and began refuting his spiritual daughter's arguments. All right, there we go, another chapter down, and what is that sly Helena up to now? It seems she has multiple men on the go, and she wants to get unmarried so that she can get remarried. Chattel Valster said, at the introduction of Helena, she seems to be a character without any depth. More and more details have been added which enrich her character. A detail, for example, from this chapter. Like a truly great person who can do whatever she likes, at once placed herself in the position of being right, in which she sincerely believed, and all the others in the position of being wrong. What has become your opinion of Helena after learning this and all the other characteristics in the book until now? Well, that made me think of a compulsive liar. If you've ever dealt with a compulsive liar, they convince themselves they're telling the truth. It's almost like they could pass a lie detector test because they kind of rewrite what happened in their head to the extent where they are convinced that they're the one in the right and everyone else is wrong, or that what they're saying is true and the reality is the bit that's incorrect. That's what it seemed like to me when she was talking about that, like she can never be in the wrong. She's the kind of person that when you deal with someone like this in real life, you kind of think, I need to put some distance here between me and this person, because it's not a matter of liking or disliking someone. It's more, you get the sense that dealing with her is only going to cause you trouble. Still, I kind of want this to go ahead, as you know, I want Pierre to be free from Helena. Although I do think it's going to cause him quite a lot of public shame, and he's going to be the one that looks like the bad guy. You know, Helena will arrange it so that that's the case. Mellow Yellow said, I'm only sympathetic to her goal so that Pierre can be free of her. Calais agreed, saying, me too. And Who Was Once Delight said, yes. Cabo Thief says, it says she went through the process. She got confessed. What I wonder is what exactly she confessed to. Any of the sins we see her committing? Stringing along two powerful men extramaritally for her own benefit? Or would those even come to her mind to confess if she sincerely believes she's right? What that she has done would she actually consider a sin worth confessing and be willing to admit to a priest? I'm imagining things like, I judged X when X did a stupid or terrible thing. Or, I felt pride when I looked fantastic in a new dress. What my mum is wondering is if she ever consummated her marriage with Pierre. She's definitely claiming she didn't, but I think she's lying. Although maybe I wouldn't put it past Pierre to have never done this and never even think about it when the book's from his perspective. Mellow Yellow said, when I read that part about her confessing, I automatically assumed she confessed little minute things. I totally agree that these bigger sins don't even occur to her as being wrong. I actually assume she confessed to adultery, I suppose, cheating on Pierre. So his argument, the father confessor, said, ignorant of the import of what you are undertaking, you made a vow of conjugal fidelity, which means a monogamous relationship, to a man who on his part, by entering the marriage state without faith in the religious significance of marriage, committed an act of sacrilege. The marriage lacked the dual significance it should have had, yet in spite of this, your vow was binding. You swerved from it. Meaning you broke the vow. Now, the vow that they're speaking of is the vow of conjugal fidelity. So she made a vow of conjugal fidelity, a vow to be in a monogamous marriage, but she swerved from it, which I think is like a euphemistic way of saying she broke it. She broke the vow. And then he goes on to argue that the breaking of the vow wasn't an evil act because of this and that. That was what I assumed. I might be wrong, though, of course. 100157 said, is it bad for me to want to see her lose a leg, too? Huh. I think we're all in the same boat there. You know, I don't know, like, the guys that she's seeing now, these other men that she's got on the go, I sort of hope that they're crappy people who deserve the trouble that they're about to get into. I don't like the thought that, you know, there might be some decent men and, you know, well, if they are decent men, I pity them. If they're terrible men, then they'd probably rather lose a leg than what's going to happen to them with Helena. Is that too harsh? She's pretty awful, isn't she? All right. That's going to do us for this chapter. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.